realization of oneness, we probably will go no further than up to page 15. The title is Pure Being. And we'll also do the seventh chapter of John up to at least verse 30. Now, while we are seeking fulfillment, in a sense really seeking identity, the Christ within is always saying, I am come. Do you not recognize me? Can you not feel my presence within you now? And until this becomes a realization and an acceptance, we walk in a divided state, seeking that which we already are, denying that which we already are, and sometimes blaming many others for our inability to demonstrate the purity of God where we stand. Now, as we look at these quotations from the first chapter of Joel's book, I'd like you to watch how gently he leads us, how softly he moves to establish in you a foundation, and that every word is to prepare you for the word that follows, so that, unlike Paul, you're not suddenly blinded at Damascus, although probably many of us would prefer that. The foundation is first built from law to grace. And so you'll find at the beginning some of the things said will seem to you rather innocent. You'll say, oh, I know that. But be sure he knows you know that. And he's recalling it to your attention so that you will be aware of it as he comes through with the next statement. And so that you will put the two together. So that you will build a necklace of truth. Now watch what I mean. He tells us that every evil in our experience stems from the belief that God in some way is responsible for it. Now you say to yourself, well, I don't really believe that God is responsible for some of these evils. But he says you do. He says in some way you believe God is responsible for it. And he is enlightening you to the truth that although you may not be aware of it, deep within you is the belief that God in some way is responsible. And it works perhaps in a negative way. For example, you accept the evil. Another part of your consciousness, you accept that God is the only creator. And therefore, in some way, you have accepted evil while accepting only one creator, and so in that manner you have accepted that the creator is responsible for the evil, although you have not consciously made that decision. And so his statement here, all evil is due to the fact that in some way or another we believe God is responsible for it. And that may not be our conscious belief or our direct belief, but when you trace the channels of thought within you, you'll discover that the source of your belief in evil is the belief that in some way it did come from God. And so now he's setting the standard for you to purify the belief that God could be a creator of evil. And so you must learn the nature of God is purity, and that from purity, only purity can follow. The nature of God is perfection, and from perfection, only perfection can follow. And then there is no potential for evil in perfection, and no capacity for evil in purity. So first we establish that God is pure. That shouldn't be difficult for us. But now we have to maintain a consistency in that knowledge. God being pure, all that emanates from God, all that expresses through God, all that is of the substance of God is equally pure. And by pure we mean incapable of error, incapable of destruction, incapable of disease, incapable of showing forth any quality other than the purity of its creator. So pure being, pure God, pure life is the story he is now beginning to narrate to us. Now he says, with the advent of that spiritual light which was embodied in the consciousness of Jesus Christ in its fullness, we are presented with a different God, a God in whom there is no darkness, a God too pure to behold iniquity. Now, you know, this is not the God of any religion. The God of religion is quite impure in the sense that he countenances evil, even sometimes visits that evil upon his children to punish them. And the God of Jesus Christ is a different God, one not of wrath, not of vengeance, not one who punishes, but a God so pure that he can behold no iniquity to punish. And you're learning there, then, that life, which is divine, is pure and never becomes tarnished in any way, so that there is no darkness in divine life, no error in divine life. And you begin to sense then that if you are finding error in yours, it is because you do not believe your life is divine. So those soul buds are opening to realize they're talking about a divine life so pure that there is never evil in it, never error, never disease, never destruction. Why would they talk about such a life if that is not the life that I am? What meaning would such a life have for me if it is not my life they're talking about? And it is your life. It is the pure divine life, which is your life, which is being presented to you as a fact, not to be attained, but to be realized as a permanent fact of your being. There is a life, which is your life, which is ever immaculate, untarnished, never less than perfectly pure and purely perfect. It must forever be perfect because it is the life of the Father, the one infinite divine life. We are all joint heirs in this life. Accepting evil is a denial of that life. Believing the possibility of evil is a denial of that life. And this constitutes the nature of the divided consciousness, which thinks it believes in God, but doesn't know what it's believing in, because God is divine life without beginning or end, without error, and to believe in it means to accept it as your life. Now, this is the foundation for the new consciousness, the consciousness that God being my life, error is impossible, and when it appears, it cannot be real. This must be established not by proving it, but by being meek unto the word of the Father. Now you find many want to prove this. It will come to them and they'll say, now, how do I know that's true? Well, what can I do to prove it? I hope most of you have reached the place now where you're not going to waste your time trying to prove that God means what God says. That you're not trying to prove that the words of the Christ may be fallible. You can save yourself a lot of time, as we discussed last week, by being from that little city of Galilee, which is confidence in the Word, meekness unto the Word. Not a great intellect who challenges the word, but one from Galilee who says, I follow the word of the Father, that is my master. This is the meekness of strength, of trust, of confidence. And if you do not have that quality, you will find that you become a squirrel. You're chasing truth and it chases you. and you never come to that place where you can say amen. It's a great quality to be able to say to the word, yes, I accept you. And it is very difficult for the mind of man, the intellect of man, to do that, as you will see later in the 7th chapter of John. This is a God introduced by Jesus who demands of us that we be as pure as we can, so pure that we can forgive our enemies, so pure that we can pray for our enemies, pray for those who despitefully use us. And so the God who was given to us by Jesus is demanding of us that we hold on to no condemnation toward anyone, that we visit no punishment on the sinner. Now you see, this is a cleansing process. It's a foundation for the next truth. The absence of condemnation. Because who shall you condemn if the only life is the life of God? Whom shall you punish if the only life is the life of God? And therefore, because the only life there is the life of God, forgiveness is the acceptance that only the life of God is there. It isn't that you should forgive this person, or condemn this person, or punish this person, or not do these things. It is that you should recognize the purity of life that is there, regardless of the form you see. And so we are being alerted to recognize that God being pure life, and the only, whatever appears in any other form to us, does not vary that fact. That unvarying truth is that pure life is everywhere now. Accepted in your consciousness as your life, the life of mother, father, brother, sister, child, the life of neighbor, the life of enemy. Not because you're a great and high moral creature, but because you're living in truth. You are worshiping God, which is the one life. Recognition of the one divine life, which is pure and without possible error, is the foundation you live with in order to be crowned with the glory of heaven. And so we proceed from that. Now, says Joel, no one would consider any man perfect who visited sin, disease, or death on another. And yet many of the beliefs from which we suffer have their roots in a universal belief that God visits these evils upon us. Now this is introducing the idea of universal belief. You may have the belief in sickness. You may have the belief in disease. You may have the belief in error. But you are only a parrot for the universal belief in these things. And so now we have universal truth of the purity of divine life without opposite, and universal error that there is a life which can be impure. And unwittingly we have in some way fallen into the belief that there is a life which can be impure. This is the universal belief most people share. There is a life which can show error. There is a life which can be destroyed. And we are being alerted to banish that belief in our consciousness. There never was such a life. There never could be, for the only life is God. And God being pure, the only life is pure. And you are not trying to weed out only your personal beliefs. You're recognizing that this is a universal belief. And a continuous outpouring of this universal belief through you, all around you, will be part of your environment until you have conquered the universal belief as it enters your consciousness and rooted it out, so that you have the pure belief in the pure life which is omnipresent. Now, if there are any gaps in your armor of truth, they're going to show forth in your life as impurity. So this isn't just a little personal matter. You can't accept pure life for you and not for anyone else. Or you can't accept pure life for mother and father and not for the rest of the world. It is one seamless fabric of purity, or you have fallen into the sense of a second life. Now that's a pretty long clothesline on which to hang our wash. It has to be an infinite clothesline. All of our inner beliefs have to be washed clean, pure, white, until nowhere within the infinite universe will you recognize that there is a possibility of life being less than pure and perfect. You can see it's something that you have to develop through quiet contemplation, through meditation, through practice as you walk through the world, always conscious that you are building your consciousness of the one pure life without opposite, not being fooled by the appearance of good forms or bad forms. Good situations or bad situations. Aware that only the pure life is ever present, this remains your unwavering consciousness until Christ is born. And Joel says, you and I have been suffering from our ignorant, unconscious acceptance of that universal belief that there can be an impure life. Now you see then, that acceptance has been unconscious, but it comes to the surface as a conscious belief. Sometimes we don't know that we are a channel for that unconscious belief because we have never encountered that cosmic state of consciousness which can see the world mind functioning through the many inhabitants of the world. Living in form, we have only seen what comes through us and around us, but never have associated it as coming from one cosmic deceiver, as a universal lie. And every time we meet it in ourselves, it somehow seems to still be there. That's because we haven't routed it out from its source, but rather only from its presence in us. We haven't recognized the nature of the source as universal. And we've even pinned these complaints about others on them, not realizing the nature of the complaint should have been the recognition of the universal source of that individual's problem, that individual's state of consciousness, that individual's fear. No one really fears. No one really hates. It is universal activity coming through as their individualized or personalized fear, personalized hate. But it's really always the universal. You lift this stigma off of the people around you, and you find what you've been calling enemy and friend and neighbor and giving labels to has all been an acceptance of universal mind unconsciously personalized down to an individual. You can look at people and start to love them when before all you could see was someone you hated. Once you lift the stigma from them and realize they are victims of a universal belief. Everywhere. And the importance of it is that when you do not do this, you're falling into the trap of believing in an impure life. And after a while, this becomes a normal, natural, daily thing for you. The conditioning is so deep, you're never quite able to get out of the mud again. And so Joel is stressing the unconscious acceptance of the universal belief to awaken us to it. Universally, the belief that an impure life is possible filters into the consciousness of every man. Let's unfilter. Let's watch. Let's be aware. Let's meet it with the knowledge that only pure life is. Now we honor our Father, says Job. Love the Lord our God with all our heart and soul. In the realization that he is too pure to behold iniquity or to cause iniquity. Now you have purity of God, the Creator, too pure to cause evil. And so you have another weapon, all evil, and evil on its lower form, such as animosity and hate and vengeance, evil of relationships between people, these subtle little things that disturb us. There's no cause. Though they appear, there's no cause. God being the only cause, God being pure, that which appears, which has no cause, is again recognized as universal thought, universal belief, manifesting through this one or that one. You, as a student of Christ, learning the nature of Christ as your own identity, cannot be trapped into the belief that these disturbances are reality and that they can excite you and stimulate you into some kind of resentment. The moment you find the hackles rising on your neck in resentment to something, you have fallen into the pattern of a universal belief in the impurity of God. And the one you're angry against is not your real problem. Your problem is that you're not honoring God supremely. You have forgotten. You have been mesmerized into the belief that there is another life than pure God life. And you're living with it, and you're accepting it. You're not following Christ, you're following the world mind. Don't blame your neighbor. Don't blame the one you're antagonistic to. Rather, recognize you have been trapped into a belief that is not true. Free yourself from the belief. And you find you have not only freed yourself from the one you're antagonistic to, but in some way they will be helped. They will be blessed. Your illumination becomes their illumination to a degree. What about man and his relationship to God, asks Job. Is not man but the form of the temple, and God the essence of his being? Once we perceive that oneness is the true relationship of God and man, and also perceive the pure nature of God in whom there is no propensity for evil, then man is recognized as pure and upright, in whom there likewise is no propensity or capacity for evil. Now you see why it had to be established that God is pure, and why it must be established that we are one with God. How can you be one with purity and be impure? But the neighbor you are antagonistic to is one with God, not in form, but in life. The life of that neighbor is one with the life of God, and therefore pure. What are you antagonistic to? The life of your neighbor? No, you're antagonistic to the form of your neighbor. You're confusing form and life. The life is pure, but you somehow think the form is the person there. And so, in a sense, you've said form and life are one and the same. You couldn't say, I know the neighbor's life is pure, but the form isn't. You're saying, that's my neighbor and I don't like her, and that's that. Look what she did. But that isn't your neighbor. You're looking at the form of your neighbor, and that form is not the life of God. Now, what life is there where the form of your neighbor is? Would you call it your neighbor's life? Has she got a personal, individualized life all by herself? Where did she get it from? We're learning that there is only one pure, infinite life. So what have you done? You have crucified God in your consciousness. You have said, God is not the life of my neighbor. You have separated her from the life of God, and in so doing, you have separated yourself. What you were really saying is, I'm reacting to the form of that person. That form over there is a gossip. That form over there is vindictive or hateful. So what are you hating? What are you resenting? You're resenting a form. Well, we learned last week all about form being an image and time and space, just points of light. You might as well get up to the TV set and look at it and say, you're no good, I hate you. You might talk to everyone on that TV set and say, I like you or I don't like you. You're talking to nothing. When you talk to a form, it is not alive. It is not alive. The life that is there is alive. The life that is there is not an animated form. The life that is there is the invisible spirit. It is the life of God. And when you are reacting to the animated form, you are, in a sense, turning away from the life of God that is there. You are denying the presence of the life of God. You are denying omnipresent life. You are falling into the trap of form. Form consciousness is mortal consciousness. Life consciousness is Christ consciousness. And as long as you look and see form and fall into the trap of reacting to form and living with form and hating form and loving form and fearing form, you're in form consciousness. But God didn't create that form. God, you know, didn't create any form that is suffering from evil. Turn ye to the light that is there, the life that is there, pure, perfect as the Father. Look through the sense of form of the mind. And so we're being alerted here now that there is a material consciousness, which is the mind consciousness that sees form everywhere. It identifies Mary Jones as a form. Mary Jones goes to the store, meaning Mary Jones's form goes to the store. Sally has dinner, meaning Sally eats dinner. Does Sally eat dinner, or does Sally's form eat dinner? Where does that food go? Into the body of Sally. And so when Sally eats dinner, we mean the body sits down and fills itself. I'm going to take a plane to Hawaii. What does that mean? It means the body gets on a plane and goes to Hawaii. Every time we speak of a person doing something or going somewhere, we're talking about that person's body going and doing. And that is the nature of the human consciousness, form consciousness. Everything we know in this world is form. We have a tree, we have a flower, we have a house, we have a car, we have people, we have animals, we have vegetables, we have minerals. They are forms, because the mind is form conscious. And as long as we're in form consciousness or mind consciousness, we're not in life consciousness. Life consciousness is the recognition of spiritual reality. It has nothing to do with form. And so our duality, our separation, is the automatic acceptance of form, which we unconsciously believe is life. You must make the distinction between what you call life, when you really mean form, and what life is. Now, the form you look at is not pure. It's subject, it's vulnerable. It can be attacked. It's dispensable. And it is limited in time, limited in space. It is only temporary. Every form you see in this world is temporary. Some may live for thousands and thousands of years, like the pyramids. But everything is temporary. Nothing is permanent. And yet the world we live in is the impermanent world of form. In your new consciousness, in your consciousness of the reality of being, you step out of the consciousness of form into the consciousness of pure life. Now look at that girl you said was sick. You meant the form was sick. Look at the life which you cannot see and accept the one divine life there. Is that one divine life sick? If God is pure, that one divine life is pure and perfect, and yet the form is sick. Why? Because you have a second consciousness. Instead of the consciousness of pure divine life, there is there the consciousness of form. And the consciousness of form is not being fed by the consciousness of life. That is the separation. In that separation, world thought enters and appears as the impurity of form. The gap is living in the wrong consciousness, form consciousness, which is sowing to the flesh. Sowing to the spirit meant living in the consciousness of pure life. Where the life is accepted in consciousness, it manifests as the purity of form. Where the essence is known and realized, it shows forth in the manifestation. Worshipping an idea called God is not enough. That's why Jesus had to reveal a new God, the God of pure life, pure being, omnipresent, and then had to train us to build that consciousness of that pure life. Otherwise, we would always be limited to good form and bad form, healthy form and sick form. Form that it was always subject to the powers of the world. We find we're able to develop the consciousness of pure life, resting in it, one with that life, accepting it to be our life. Your life is the pure life of God. But if your consciousness rests on form, thinking it is your life, you're really turning away from your own life. Awakening from the belief that my form and my life are one and the same. I am no longer mesmerized. I step up to higher ground. My life is the life of God. God's life is pure. My life is pure. The only thing that made the form impure in some way was that I had closed my mind. I had not known the invisible pure life that is ever present. Now, when you make your adjustment, regardless of how much time it takes, you are accepting the new God revealed by Jesus Christ. That God is pure life. God is life, and that life is the light of all men. You step out of form consciousness. There you dwell in your secret place that I am the life. Jesus was the form. And as Jesus learned he was the life, he was Christed. Christ was the life, Jesus the form. That's the sequence, from Jesus to Christ, from form to life, from physical, fleshly form of a human being to the pure life of God. And the travel takes no greater distance than where you are, because it's a matter of consciousness. Your form coming from the mother's womb, but the second birth is, I am the pure life of God. Universal belief prevents this. Universal belief keeps us form conditioned. But enlightenment lifts you out of universal belief, breaking the karma of that false conditioning into form. And just as Jesus becomes aware that he is life or Christ, you become aware that you are life or Christ. Thou seest me, thou seest the life of the Father. There is no other here. I and the Father are one life. Was that not his secret? That he wasn't Jesus born in the mother's womb anymore. He had learned himself to be the life of God. He had accepted his divine parent as the reality of his being. I would suggest that whoever has not tried to lift themselves from form consciousness into life consciousness, begin immediately. And you'll find, whereas you had looked out at many, many forms, you'll begin to look out at one pure, invisible life. And the forms won't be that significant to you. They'll be there. But you'll be knowing the invisible reality where each form appears. And instead of separated forms and many forms, you'll be in the consciousness of one pure life through which all of the seeming forms are walking. Your secret place is the one pure life, unseparated, not the many forms. And include yourself. I am the pure life of God. That should be your permanent consciousness. Before we can wipe sin, disease, accident, poverty, or injustice from this earth, we must first remove it from God. You'll find that on page 7 of Realization of Oneness. If you think any of these things exist in God, or even permit yourself to believe that they exist in the world, you have thought that in some way God either causes them or permits them, or that God is not all. In other words, you're not accepting one indivisible, pure life everywhere called God. Now, if none of these evils can exist in that pure life called God, then they cannot exist. And the moment then you have accepted that they are not in God, the one pure life, it follows that they are not in the world. They only seem to be. Your conscious awareness of the truth helps dissolve the seeming appearance. Now on page 7 he says, for man to be holy, God must be holy. So the beginning of freedom for you and for me is to have a God who is wholly good, meaning entirely good. God from whom can come forth nothing but spirit, eternality, justice. The goodness that is in God is innate in the goodness of his creation. The allness of God is the assurance that that allness must be the nature of your being. If we claim God is wholly good, that still has no effect on life as I am, as long as I am separate and apart from that God. What good is a perfect God if that God and I are separated from each other? What can that do for you? What good would come from God's being perfect if you and I were something separate and apart from God, subject to other influences? But I and the Father are one. Now, when Jesus declared this, if you were not from that state of consciousness which is Galilee or meekness unto the Father, you would poo-poo his remark, I and the Father are one. Well, that means him. It doesn't mean me. But he's citing a truth that is infinite. The life of you is I. I am the life. I, the life, I and the Father are one. The life of you and the Father are one. That is a universal truth, a spiritual truth that never changes. The life of you and the life of God are one. Do you still think you can be sick? That your life can be sick? The moment it is, you're saying the life of God and I are two. Because the life of God cannot be sick. It can suffer no disturbance whatsoever. The life of God can never end. Can your life end? If it can, you are saying that I and the Father are two. But the truth is that I and the Father are one. You simply do not have a life that can end. Is God a day older today? Did you think that because today is a day after yesterday that you're a day older? You're thinking of your form. Your life isn't a day older. And your life won't be a day older tomorrow. Your life isn't living in time. Your life is the life of God. It is eternal. It knows nothing of time. Your life is never aging. Your life is never sick. Your life is never deteriorating. But the form thinks so because we have accepted the form as my life. Your new consciousness sheds this. My life is the life of God. I and the Father are one, even though it's taken me 2,000 years to finally accept that. My life is named I, because I am the life. And my life is the life of God, because there is no other life. They are one life. And that is my consciousness. And then the form which ages, the form which deteriorates, the form which ends, has nothing to do whatsoever with my life. It's like your automobile. It has nothing to do with your life. It has a function. But it is not your life. And in your life consciousness, you are in a Christ consciousness. And you are accepting the new dispensation of one pure, infinite, eternal life, which is my life. And therefore you know that there is in your life no capacity for evil, no capacity for sin, no capacity for pain, no capacity for resentment, no capacity for animosity, no capacity for lack or limitation. And if you insist on feeling these things, it should be an alert to you that you're living in form consciousness instead of in life consciousness. Because in life consciousness, you are too pure to behold iniquity, for there is none in life. You only behold iniquity in form. Form is visible, life is invisible. Form is mortal, life is immortal. When you are in the consciousness of the invisible, the immortal life, it will overflow into your visible, mortal sense of life. It will show forth as harmonious form. But you must let go of the consciousness of form, which separates you from your immortal life, which must and always will be the source of all that appears in the visible. And if you don't have the source, you've got something floating in time and space which is subject to every human power. So you're finding a new anchor, a new focus, new place to live. Your own immortal, infinite, pure life. It's always present. It's always now. The consciousness that moves over to it is able to live from that level. The moment we declare the infinite, perfect, spiritual nature of God, we are also declaring the perfection of our own being. The infinite way, infinite life, infinite pure life is the nature of your being. Now, on page 9, we have, says Joel, only one creator. That one, without capacity for sin or evil. So we need no power over sin. No power over disease, no power over death, because they have no existence in God, and if they do not exist in God, they do not exist. While you've been fighting to remove this and that and the other thing that was disturbing and causing fear, you have not been acknowledging the one perfect creator. And so you've inadvertently said, something caused this. You've inadvertently said, there's another creator around here. God isn't the only creator. Inadvertently you've said, because God isn't the only creator, there must be another kind of life here than divine life. And you merely suffer from the ignorance that there is no other kind of life, and there is no other creator. There's only that one life. Always, the separation from the knowledge that only the one divine life is present leaves us sort of hopeless and helpless, because no matter what we seem to do in the visible mortal world, while we're denying the presence of the one divine life, nothing seems to help, because we're without substance. We're trying mentally to do something or physically to do something, and we're not going to the level of reality. So the best we can do is something superficial and temporary, until we labor not for the meat that perisheth, but go directly to the truth that even the one who is suffering is not that which God created. Nothing God created is suffering. Why don't we get to the identity of that individual instead of to the form appearance? The identity is pure life of God. There's no other way that you can bless any individual on this earth except by the recognition of the pure divine life which stands where the form appears to be. We must be true to the pure being that is God, recognizing that pure being where every mortal form seems to be. That pure being is the life where the mortal form appears. That pure being is the life where your mortal form appears. That pure being has been your life as long as there has been a God. There's no one who is not as old as God. The newborn babe is as old as the mother. Why? They are both the same life. The life of God, pure, forever. It takes identity, realized, understood, lived in, believed, practiced. Otherwise, what are you practicing? You're practicing the absence of divine life. And what do you suffer from? The practice of the absence of divine life. And so many are practicing the absence of divine life so long that all that can show forth is their belief in the absence of divine life, which is impurity, lack, limitation, and the rest. When you're not practicing the presence of divine life, you're practicing the absence of it. Well, you're not practicing the presence of God, you're practicing the presence of mammon. When you're not practicing the presence of life, you're practicing the presence of form. This is the nature of fallen man. This is the nature of a divided consciousness. It's seeking its own divine life, unaware that it is present. And in its helpless state, it reaches out in all directions, never knowing that what it's really seeking merely has to be accepted as the fact of being right now. It's always invisible, but always present. You're seeking your own immortal self. Isn't this leading up to that we believe we are mortal beings, and we must learn that we are immortal life? Do you have a consciousness that you are immortal life? Have you built it? Have you worked with it? Have you tried to understand that you are immortal life, not mortal form? Isn't that the new identity we are establishing? Immortal life is your reality. Mortal form is your appearance. In which one are you living? When your consciousness tells you that I am immortal life, you will face every circumstance around you with that as your anchor. Can immortal life be feared or frightened? Can immortal life be shattered? Can immortal life be ended? The very nature of immortal life accepted is the answer to just about anything that could possibly antagonize you or oppose you or threaten you. And that's what is carefully being established here in the knowledge that God being all and God being the only cause and creator, all that can emanate would be that which is of the purity of that life. That life being immortal, what else can happen but immortal life? And so your new consciousness now establishes firmly there is, where this form appears to be, another self, a self that is not mortal, is not temporary, did not begin at such a date and does not end at such a date, and is not subject to mortal powers. There is an immortal self right where you stand. That immortal self is the life of God. That is the eye of your being. I am that immortal life. You've got to live in it, not talk about it. You've got to understand it. You've got to accept it and then listen to it. Trust it. Be a Galilean. One who can accept the immortal life that is present and walk forward boldly and confidently, knowing my immortal life is all there is of me. The form consciousness becomes part of your many human yesterdays. The consciousness that I am the immortal life of God is a vital necessity for the continuance of your study and the progression into the final total realization of yourself as the living essence, who is independent of all form, all human conditions, all lacks, all limitations, and has total dominion over all that appears in this world. Only the immortal life of God has that dominion. And if you were given that dominion, you must be that immortal life. You must exercise that reality. That's the meaning of the house or the consciousness of immortality. That's precisely the reason this is called Immortality House. Your consciousness of the immortal life of your own being is Immortality House. You, conscious of your own immortality, are Immortality House. The Father is building your house, your consciousness of immortality. That is your correct identity. That is your substance. That is your law. That is the reality of your being. God cannot give us life, says Joel, and God cannot give us death. God is eternal life, and his life is the life of our being. He doesn't give it, he is it. If there were a God life and our life, God life might be immortal and ours mortal. But if God is infinite, God is infinite life, and that means God is your life and my life. And so our immortal life, clearly stated by our teacher, there is no other life but the pure divine life of God, which is immortal and yours and mine now. This is an immortality tomorrow. This is an immortality in time, a dying to become immortal later. This is the acceptance of immortal life now, which is a totally different understanding of immortality than the world has. God life is immortal, and God life is now your life, and there you are. We're going to meditate a moment now to contemplate this idea of the immortal life of God, which is now my life and has ever been since before Abraham. Before Abraham, I am immortal life. Unto the end of the world, I am immortal life. Is there another beside immortal life? I know not any. That's what is a disciple of God. One living in the knowledge that I am the immortal life of the Father, and the Father dwelleth in me, and I in the Father. We are one life. We are accepting pure being as the infinite reality of all. Not just my being, but everyone who walks this earth. Only pure being exists, without flaw anywhere. For we are no longer walking in the false belief that form and life are one and the same. Now see that wherever that immortal life is, it is your life. It isn't just in your chair. Wherever it is the same life. Your consciousness of that immortal life everywhere as your life is the full meaning of I and the Father are one. Wherever the divine life is, I am. Wherever I am, the divine life is. There's no break where I begin and end. I am the one divine life. Begin to feel that in the presence of any form anywhere. When you begin to feel that your shoulders are going out 14 miles in every direction, you begin to feel the ever-present light of your own being. Don't limit yourself to a little space or a moment in time. The one divine life is infinite and eternal, and it is your name. Don't be afraid of it, or else you're denying the one immortal life to be the all. Don't try to cut a piece of it like a piece of pie. It is without seam. It is beyond the horizon. It is in the sky. It is under the ocean. It is everywhere. We never divide his garment. We never divide his life. We simply rest in the knowledge that the one perfect life everywhere is my own being. And watch it manifest itself as the harmony that appears where your form seems to be and where the forms around you seem to be. All that you had wanted to correct will be taken care of in the knowledge of the truth of one divine life.